Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and for the non-computer scientist who stumbles across lines of code, it doesn't look like a real language. It looks nonsensical, a jumbled mess that doesn't mean anything. But my next guest is someone who understands the language of literature and the language of computer code and lays out the beauty of both in his new book. His name is Vikram Chandra, and he's a computer programmer, novelist, and now the author of a new nonfiction book called Geek Sublime. Welcome to WNYC.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
One of the strangest facts the book explains is that most computer programmers today really don't understand how computers work. How is that possible?
Well, in the early days, in the 30s and 40s, if you wanted to work with computers, you were actually working with the hardware. Each time you had to solve a new problem, you essentially built a new computer. And so you had to understand binary code, you had to understand logic, and you had to understand how to drive those to solve a problem. What's happened over the last 50-odd years is that a series of higher-level languages that look more like spoken languages, often English, have been built, so that now you can manipulate the machine, get it to do things by using lines that go something like print this to the screen, and it'll do it. So there's no need for you to actually understand what's at the bottom.
You don't need to know the hardware in order to be a master of the software.
Indeed.
And you write about how the way computer codes are put together is similar to the way Sanskrit, or at least the scientific version of Sanskrit, as you call it, works. What do you mean by that?
Well, there's an astonishing connection between the world that we live in today, which is so dominated by software, and a grammar written in about 500 BCE by a man named Parnini. And the interesting thing about that grammar, which is called the Ashtadhyayi, eight chapters, is that it's not a paradigmatic grammar in the sense that you or I might have encountered in second grade, where they show you declensions of a verb and you have to learn by heart, and then that's how you learn to speak the language. The Ashtadhyayi comprises 3,976 rules, which a modern-day computer programmer would recognize as a rule set. And these rules act on strings. So what happens is you take a verb root or a nominal stem, and if you want it to have a certain case and a certain gender, first person, active, you put it through the rules, which set each other off. And then at the end, out pops a word, a Sanskrit word, in the correct form. So what it actually is a very complex algorithm which produces an infinity of Sanskrit words and Sanskrit sentences. And it has an interesting career in the West. It's discovered by the first flowering of Orientalist research in the 18th century, gets translated first by the Germans, and then gradually becomes much of the basis of much of modern linguistics.
That's fascinating. So listeners, if you have any personal experiences as to how computer code and literature connect, the language of literature and the language of computer code, call and talk about it. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, or anything else you want to ask Vikram Chandra, whose new nonfiction book is called Geek Sublime, 212-433-9692. And since we mentioned Sanskrit, the book dives into post-colonial Indian history and explains at least partially why there are so many Indians working in computer science. And I guess it all started with Prime Minister Nehru right after independence. So what did he do to foster generations of computer scientists in India?
Well, I think he and all the other politicians and planners of that era were very aware that they had inherited a shattered economy. In about 1650, India was producing about 25% of the world's manufacturing. And once the colonial presence came in, they, in a sense, just treated India as a source of raw materials and then as a market for finished goods. And so what, after 250-odd years of that, you end up is a non-developed economy. So they poured a lot of money and resources into setting up the Indian Institutes of Technology, which were designed from the start to produce world-class engineers. And it was controversial at the time, and is still controversial. What are you doing setting up these very high-level institutions, which were modeled after MIT, in a country where you have hungry people and you can't get clean water to them? But what that resulted in is that over the years, there was a cadre of very excellent engineers that came, that were produced generation after generation. And the world took notice, and companies from Germany and England, and specifically the United States, Silicon Valley, started snapping them up from the campuses. And so what that resulted in is that at the particular time that the internet allowed certain economies of scale to be applied overseas, India was ready with a workforce that was capable of dealing with that.
Pretty interesting and pretty good foresight. And you explained that the very first computer programmers were more actually women. But as most people know now, in the U.S., only about one-fifth of programmers are women. So why did it start out more female? And how has the culture fostered such a male tech workforce over time?
I particularly depended in this book on a terrific history written by Nathan Ansmenger called The Computer Boys Take Over, and in which he explains that as the first programmable computers were put into operation in the mid-1940s, the social and gender hierarchies were very present. So at that point, incredibly enough, nobody had just had realized that that programming computers was very hard. Everyone thought that the intellectual work of making up the algorithms and data structures to solve a problem, that was the scientific work. And so the scientists were all male, and they were called the planners. And the idea was that they would produce these plans, and then they would hand them off to a kind of secretarial workforce, the programmers, the coders, who would just enter it kind of mechanically into the machine. And as it happened, because it was secretarial, all of them were women. And then once it was realized that the skill of programming is actually intellectually demanding and very valuable, over the decades, the craft, what was thought of then as a kind of low-level craft, gets professionalized, and certain ideas about gender get attached to that. It gets made male as it gets more and more status.
I think we have a great question coming in from Tom in Red Bank. Tom, you're on WNYC. Hi.
Oh, hi. How are you? I have a question. There was a comment by John Bentley, a computer scientist, that once said he would rather write a computer program that writes a program than write a program. So I'm interested in finding out your speaker's comments about languages that computer people use that will write other computer programs. I'm thinking in particular about Unix, Alex, and Awk, things like that.
Right. So you want him to talk about that? Let me, if I might, did you also tell our screener that you were going to ask the question, is there beauty in computer language?
I find this idea of languages that write other languages as a beautiful thing, almost a poetic thing. Uh-huh. And I was in the computer field for a long time, and I found a great deal of beauty in that.
Thank you very much. So let me take that part of it first,
okay,
if I can.
Sure.
For people who are disconnected from this world and think, oh, writing computer code, though you can create incredible things to be done on the computer through it, it's all ones and zeros. It must be so deadly. Is there beauty in computer code?
Indeed, there is. I would argue very strongly that there is. The reason being that as Donald Knuth, a famous programmer and computer scientist, explained to us in the early 1980s, we're not really writing code for the machine. That's almost incidental. We're writing code for the other programmers who maybe 2 years from now and maybe 20 years from now will try and fix our code. They will try and extend it or adapt it. And so, therefore, if you write code that is impenetrable, that is ugly, they're not going to be able to read it. So there's a great emphasis placed on clarity, on expressiveness. So as I read down a screen full of code, it should tell me a story about what it's trying to do. And also, the immense size of programming artifacts makes this very important. For instance, there's a 2008 distribution of the operating system Linux that was made up of 200 million lines of code. Right.
Wow.
So that is immense. So the architecture itself has to reveal intentionality, and it has to all fit together in a way that can come apart easily and be amended easily.
To this point, we have a comment on our website from Antonio from Bayside, who writes, "I've been making the transition from graphic design to coding in recent years, and I was delightfully surprised in finding how much thought goes into code's presentation, tab breaks, syntax coloring. In fact, the language Ruby, I guess that's a coding language, yes, personifies a kind of beauty analogous to a haiku."
Exactly. And it the creator of Ruby, actually, who's a famous another famous programmer named Matz, argues in an essay about the beauty of code that it code should it's built for the happiness of the programmer, right? And therefore, simplicity and clarity and allowing the programmer with the least amount of effort to express his or her intention is the ideal towards which all code moves.
Vikram Chandra, author of Geek Sublime. So back to Tom and Red Bank's original question, about languages that create other languages.
Right. Well, I think there's more and more of that effort going on. Certainly, if you're working in a high-level language like Ruby, when you write one sentence, that actually gets converted into thousands of instructions as it proceeds down the stack. Although I should say that one of the frustrations of the history of programming is that it still remains really, really hard. Right. So right from the 1950s, there was this promise made by every generation of technologists that someday there would be a language that civilians, non-programmers, could use to tell their machines to do things, and it would be beautiful. You know, if you wanted, there's a Butler Lampson was a computer scientist in the 70s, and he foresaw a future in which people would write code as easily as people write poetry with a pencil. And of course, that hasn't come to pass. There's too much ceremony. You have to learn 16 different things to do the simplest thing. And I think that's a kind of failure that of on the programming side. The hardware people have been delivering incredible advances year after year after year. But I think the programming side has remained too obscure.
Fascinating. 212-433-WNYC. Kate in Sparkhale, you're on WNYC. Hi, Kate.
I was first programming a computer for money in 1963. Uh-huh. I was in London. I worked for an engineering company, which was an American engineering company, and they rented time from ITT Ferranti, which was Alan Turing's old company, and from IBM. And I wrote the first programs for complicated mathematics. I did the Navier-Stokes equations, which describe fluid motion. Mm-hmm. And I agree with you about language and beauty. Incidentally, I speak, depending on how you count it, 5 or 6 languages. I first got into puzzles and games, I guess, by around 1955. Charles Lutwidge Dodgson, Lewis Carroll to you, wrote a book called Symbolic Logic and the Game of Logic, and he invented a precursor to a Venn diagram. It was a four-box thing where you could diagram the logic of sentences. I was playing with that when I was in high school.
Wow. So, Kate, can I ask you, as somebody who was programming computers at an engineering firm in 1963, were your colleagues doing that more female than you might find today, as Vikram was relating some of that early history?
How was I doing as a female?
Were there other women who were doing it too? Or was it an overwhelmingly male enterprise at that time?
Overwhelmingly male. And before I worked in London, I worked in San Francisco for the other big engineering company whose name starts with B. I had more difficulty with male egos in the States than I did in England. In England, I was just a curiosity. in England, in the States, I was a challenge.
Was it a very exciting time for you doing that early, anticipating what the possibilities were for...
The whole world was exciting. I was young, of course. And I left this country for political reasons, actually. And I walked into the chief competitor's office in London and said, give me a job. And they gave it to me because I had worked for their competitor and I knew, you know, the routine stuff of estimates and so forth.
And you spilled the bean on all their secrets?
What?
You spilled the beans on all their secrets?
No, not exactly. I was urged out of the California company.
I see.
And at the time, I thought it was because I had cooked the books for them a few times. I didn't know the name of the job I cooked the books on, but I was very good at that, too.
Now it can be told. Kate, thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you.
Fascinating stories. Rita in Jamaica, you're on WNYC. Hi, Rita.
Hi. How are you?
Okay.
Okay, so I write novels for kids and teens, and back in the 80s, in a different work, I was stringing like BASIC and a little SQL and DBMS and like command-based languages.
Old languages, right.
Oh, yeah. And so a few years later, I happened to read a colleague, Karen Hess's book, and called The Music of Dolphins. And as I read, I said to myself, oh, wow, you know, this child acquiring language is just like, you know, like elementary basic programming or database programming. And so I always kind of kept that with me. And so when I go out and I do workshops with kids, if I do a little poetry or a little character sketching, I always try to keep it very basic and kind of very active, almost command-driven, so that they can really snap to language very quickly.
So you learned from your computer coding back then some techniques for how to teach children to read, is what you're saying, right?
Or enjoy literature a lot more and participate as writers.
Right, so even to deepen not just the basic appreciation. Is this all ringing a bell to you, two callers?
Right. No, I mean, and it's certainly with the earlier callers, it's an honor to speak to some of these pioneers. I mean, we are living through an extraordinarily exciting time. And perhaps it's interesting in the Chinese way, right, where it's a curse. May you live in interesting times. But we've seen the world transform itself through this new technology. It's as if we're living through a kind of print revolution. And I do think, that there are certain virtues of clarity, of economy, that are very important in computer code that then become, that sort of transfer over into the world of writing, and that are also virtues on the other side. Although I should say that finally what you're trying to achieve with code is very different from what you're trying to achieve with poetic language, with literary language, in that with code, you have to be denotative. You have to say exactly what you mean. And if you introduce any ambiguity, that can result in disaster, right? At the very low level, you know, your computer crashes. And at the high level, I mean, you end up killing people, right? Mm-hmm. Because everything in our world now is run by algorithms. Whereas with poetry, you are delighting in a kind of purposeful ambiguity. You introduce layers and layers and layers of meaning. So at some point, there's resemblances and analogies, and at some point, the two...
They break down.
They break down, yeah.
Frank in Brooklyn, I think a fan of your fiction writing. Hi, Frank. You're on WNYC.
Hello. Good morning. Yes. I was wondering, I'm not sure this question is on point, but Mr. Chandra's books are so good, and I particularly liked a great detective story he wrote called Sacred Games. I'm wondering how he jumped into, you know, the nonfiction of this very fascinating computer language topic.
Well, I was working on some new fiction. Oh, and thanks for the compliment. That's very gratifying to hear. I was working on some new fiction, and as often happens, you sometimes hit a lull in your writing. And it's not a block. It's just that your characters are in a certain place, you have a landscape, but you don't quite know what's going to happen next. And my usual method for getting through those kinds of pauses is just to wait and to watch movies and listen to lots of music, sort of feed my brain, and somehow the solution pops up. And this time, for some reason, I thought I would write a short essay about a kind of ethnography of computer programmers for people like my wife, Melanie, who's a complete non-geek. And I was thinking of it as a kind of glossy magazine essay, and it grew, and then it was 100 pages and 200 pages, and I ended up, amazingly enough, with a book.
It's such an interesting word to use about the computer world, ethnography. Yeah. So it's really about the people.
Right.
The geeks as almost an ethnic group,
right.
A self-selected ethnic group.
I think like any other profession or specialty, there forms over time a set of behaviors, of virtues, of values, and also a mythology, right, in which certain actors become sort of the models for behavior. And so I wanted to get that across and then also explore some of the differences across cultures so that the computing culture in India is not the same as the computing culture in Silicon Valley. And so I wanted to get at that as well.
And is that a gender difference too, to some degree? Because Silicon Valley leaders seem to prize employees who embody notions of tough masculinity. You quote one tech CEO who says things like, "My coders will beat up your coders any day of the week." Nate practices knife fighting for fun, talking about one of his people. So in India, it turns out that there are many more girls learning computer science proportionally than in the U.S.
Right. So it's a seeming paradox in that, as we all know, women in India face fierce problems of inequity and sexism in the most sort of ugliest kinds of ways. But for various historical reasons, the production of certain kinds of knowledge is not gendered as male, and engineering being one of them. And you can see this, there's been a lot of sociological and anthropological scholarly research done over the last two decades, because people have noticed that, for instance, the proportion of Indian women who are programmers is about 30%, as opposed to 21-odd in the United States. And what they've discovered is that starting from school, girls are encouraged and to go into mathematics and into the scientific disciplines. One survey asked the question to undergraduates, do you feel isolated within your discipline? And 7% of women engineers said yes, whereas 18% of the men said yes.
Huh.
So the women feel more at home in engineering than the men. And this then translates into a larger proportion being in women, and the numbers keep rising. It's very, very clear that more and more women are getting into it.
Jesse in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Jesse.
Yeah, hi. I was wondering about the connection that he brought up about the Sanskrit basis for the programming character of modern language, and I've been noticing a lot of structural design in language all my life, just picking out examples, but like communication is making something communal, and I'm wondering if that relates to the computer technique of always checking the message to make sure that both computers have the same thing, that kind of structural relationship. Does that come from Sanskrit?
Well, I don't know, but I mean, I think the manner in which modern computer languages are generated and defined does bear a very strong resemblance to the Sanskrit grammars. And if you look back at the history of modern linguistics, Ferdinand de Saussure, who we all know as the father of structural linguistics, was a Sanskrit professor. Leonard Bloomfield, who set the direction of much of American linguistics in the 20th century, was also a Sanskrit professor.
Hmm.
Noam Chomsky, with his generative linguistics, always talked about his debt to Panini. So I think they took those ideas and sort of reformulated them and extended them. And so when in the 50s, computer programmers are trying to find ways to create formal languages, that is, of course, where they go.
Fascinating. I just want to touch on one thing, because as we talk about the connection between coding and Sanskrit, the connection between coding and literature, in any language. At least here in the U.S., a lot of coders seem to be musicians. And they say they find a similarity between coding and composing music. I visited Case Western Reserve University in Cleveland a few years ago, and they told me that the most common double major there is engineering and music,
That's
which might be counterintuitive unless you know.
Right.
But maybe because of the mathematical rules and structure in both music and coding. Do you buy the analogy?
Well, I think it's I do see it, but I think it's culturally constructed because I've never seen that in India. I've
really?
Not heard of programmers making a link with music, although some of them are very passionate listeners. So for some reason, I think it's limited to the United States as far as I know.
Well, really fascinating and sublime as we leave it there with Vikram Chandra, computer programmer, novelist, and now the author of the new ethnography, as he calls it, called Geek Sublime. The book is out now. Thank you so much for coming on the show. I appreciate the conversation.
Thank you.